Hey, it's Brother One.
And Brother Two.
From Two Brothers Mattress.
You'll spend 33% of this year on your mattress.
That's almost 3,000 hours.
Start sleeping comfortably now on a new Tempur-Pedic mattress.
Visit one of our five stores or twobrothersmattress.com.
With our lowest price guarantee
and our 100-night trial,
your locally owned Two Brothers Mattress is your number one choice for Tempur-Pedic mattresses. Visit one of our five stores or twobrothersmattress.com.
Twobrothersmattress.com.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome to KSL at Night. This is Taylor Morgan alongside a brand new host here at KSL at Night that is joining me tonight and will be a regular contributor and a host here on the show. Very excited to introduce him in one moment. Before that, I just want to remind you listeners that if you do miss any of our shows here on KSL at Night or any other shows on KSL News Radio, remember you can always go back and listen to not only full shows, but any segments of shows on KSLpodcast.com after the show has been aired. Really easy to find all the segments and all the shows. For our show, just look up KSL at Night at KSLpodcast.com. With that said, Rusty Cannon, welcome to KSL at Night. So thrilled to have you co-hosting. You and I have crossed paths many, many times over many years in Utah politics, at the Utah legislature. Mm-hmm. In fact, we worked together on some legislation just this last, back in February of this year. So I am thrilled to have you joining us here on KSL at Night. Tell us a little bit about your background. You're currently president of the Utah Taxpayers Association. Anything and everything about taxes, you're going to have the inside track on. I'm thrilled with that. Rusty, with all that said, please introduce yourself.
Well, thanks. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate it. I guess somebody thought I had a face for radio, and here I am, right?
So you and me both, yes.
President of the Utah Taxpayers Association. I'm actually a lifetime resident of Utah, born and raised here. And
yeah.
I was a graduate. I guess I'm getting old now. I'm going to talk about history. I graduated from East High. I was an East High Leopard before it was cool to be a Leopard.
Really?
Yeah.
That must have been what, before Zac Efron?
Yes. I think where my school was is now the atrium or something. I mean, it's totally changed.
Yeah.
I think the only thing left is the assembly hall or what have you. But yeah, East High grad, University of Utah grad, proud Ute all along. And,
I love it. Go
I've
Utes.
Been, yeah.
Go
I've
Utes.
Been here essentially all of our lives. With the exception of a few years, lived in Idaho for just a bit, but love Utah and been here. Been with the Taxpayers Association since 2018.
Wow.
Believe it or not, the association is 102 years old.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I had no idea that it's been around for that long. I have tracked the Taxpayer Association closely, just having been involved in Utah politics. I've followed former State Senator Howard Stevenson during his tenure there. I believe Billy Hesterman spent some time there. There's been so many really movers and shakers and leaders that have been involved with the organization. Tell us today, what are you working on? What are you worried about? What are the priorities?
Well, there's plenty of stuff to keep a taxpayer up at night. There's no shortage of that. Essentially, 102 years of being the state tax watchdog. So there's three-legged stool in Utah, right? Property tax, sales tax, income tax. We deal with all three.
Too many legs on the tax stool, if you ask me.
That's true. Some states only do two, but we'll talk about that at some other time. But essentially, we weigh in on those issues, watch those issues on the state level.
Yeah.
With the legislature, the governor, what have you, on the county level, city level, school district level, all levels, because it's happening all over. And, there's always issues popping up. It's interesting. We actually have a copy of the original newsletter in our office from January of 1923.
Oh, wow.
Volume one, essentially.
Yeah.
It was sent out from the Kearns building, believe it or not. It was around then. The postage on it was 1 cent.
By the way, the Kearns building is haunted. I used to work there during college.
Doesn't surprise me.
It is absolutely haunted, listeners. Just a PSA. Sorry, Rusty.
No, no problem. And, what's interesting is the first newsletter, they're complaining about the state revenue, essentially the taxes, going from roughly $8 million statewide to about $17 million in about 6 years.
Yeah.
So it's just how things change. But as we look through the historical newsletters that are there, it's pretty humbling to read, first of all,
yeah,
and to be part of the process. But the same issues. Yeah. It's funny how things have not changed in 100 years.
Yeah.
Government expands, you have to push back. Taxes go up, you have to push back. Good ideas come along, bad ideas, depressions, wars, you know, all kinds of things come and go. And it's fascinating to read that history and be part of it. So it's a great organization, 102 years, making people upset all along.
No, I love that. I have so many questions for you about taxes, and that sounds really boring, listeners. So don't worry, I'm not going to go there. But I do want to ask, from your experience with the Taxpayer Association and with, you know, everything from the legislative budget this year and the prior years, we have this sense here in Utah that we're doing so well economically, right? We have such a strong, growing economy. The tech sector is burgeoning and growing here in Utah. We have a lot of very good things going for us with, right, the ability to attract and retain talent and all of the very unique, special things about Utah that make us feel really good about our economy. Things aren't perfect, though. But no. What I want to ask is, in terms of taxes and how we as Utahns are doing with taxes in general, the three legs of the stool you mentioned, where are we now compared to where we were, say, 20, 30 years ago? Is all this growth covering up increased taxes or that we are feeling better about? Or are we doing okay when it comes to minimizing taxes?
You know, we're doing okay. It's all relative, but let me go through each leg of that stool. So first of all, property tax. Our property tax law is model legislation for the rest of the country, actually, where there's other states mimicking our property tax laws. It's truth in taxation, right?
Okay.
And that's a whole nother story, but it's a great system where the local entities have to go through a truth in taxation hearing to raise their budgets and to raise your taxes. That's first of all. Second, income tax. We used to be the cool kid on the block back in 2007 when we went to a flat income tax and lowered it to roughly 5%.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. We're no longer the cool kid at all.
We're going to get rid of the income tax at some point, right, Rusty?
Yeah, well, we'd love to have that conversation. The governor brought that up a few months ago at our conference. That's a long-term conversation. It's a big one. But that's, you know, there's states doing it. It's totally possible. And then sales tax, we're kind of in the middle of the road, right, on sales tax. The problem with sales tax is death by a thousand cuts. All these localities have all these different little taxes they put on. So you're, you know, depending on where you're buying a burger through the state, you might pay 6% somewhere and 9% somewhere else, just depending on where you are.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of stuff we educate everybody on and talk about and try to, you know, hopefully make it interesting and insightful. That's really our job to make sure people are aware of it.
Well, I'm so excited that you're joining the show, Rusty, because listeners, as many of you may know, we have some very, very big questions coming up this year on the ballot in November.
Big one.
Dealing with taxes, with the income, the earmark for education, spending for the state's income tax. We have the sales tax on food is coupled with that on the ballot.
Correct.
We have some huge questions that voters will have to wrestle with. And your background, your expertise is going to be so insightful. It's so helpful for our listeners. So Rusty Cannon, president of the Utah Taxpayer Association, brand new host at KSL at Night. We're going to break you in here. It's going to be a lot of fun. You're going to laugh at all my dumb jokes eventually.
Can't wait.
Listeners, you're going to want to stick with us here on the show because coming up next, we have a very heavy hitter in Utah's business scene, Derek Miller, who is CEO, president of the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce, will be joining KSL at Night to talk about Utah's economy. You know, we mentioned it is booming. The economy is growing. Business is strong. Utah's the best state for business, if not in the very top two or three.
Oh, we're always ranked high. And the point we try to get across to many people is we didn't get here by accident. It takes a lot of work to get here. And if we're not careful, we will lose that spot.
Yeah. Well, listeners, stay right here with us on KSL at Night. We will have Derek Miller on next to talk about the future of Utah's economy after the break.
It's finally time to say goodbye to the snow and hello to spring. And right now is the best time to spring into adventure in an RV from a Motorsportsland RV center. Through this week, come check out Motorsportsland's season kickoff event and find the RV you've been dreaming of. Save thousands and even tens of thousands off MSRP and find your next adventure at a Motorsportsland RV center today.
Let Motorsportsland help you get away.
Motorsportsland.com.
Hey, Casey Scott here, and I want to tell you about my podcast, Project Recovery. sponsored by Reprieve Recovery. It's a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's about recovery. My co-host, Dr. Matt Woolley, and I hear stories about overcoming addiction and going from rock bottom to living a healthier and sober lifestyle.
We also share strategies with people at all stages of recovery, and we hope it'll help you find what works best for you, and we can support one another. That's Project Recovery, a KSL podcast. Subscribe for free anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Did you know you can get the three things you need to know delivered right to you? Just go to KSLNewsRadio.com, click on menu, and then newsletter.
Or go to the KSL News Radio app, and you click on menu, and then it's email alerts.
This is even easier. Just text the word inbox to 57500.
Get the top national and local stories with the three things you need to know newsletter.
The murder of two men forces their families to wrestle with impossible questions. Who is forgiveness for? Does everyone deserve a second chance? Follow season two of The Letter, Ripple Effect, at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL, KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Rusty Cannon, and I'm here with Taylor Morgan. And tonight, Taylor, we're going to be talking about something pretty exciting, about the future of Utah's economy.
Oh, I thought you were going to be talking about our guest's new calling.
I think our guest had a busy weekend.
Yes.
We are going to be talking now to Derek Miller, president and CEO of the Salt Lake Chamber. Welcome to the show, Derek.
So good to be with both of you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. You bet. So there's been some exciting headlines lately about Utah rising and the future of Utah's economy. And you guys at this Salt Lake Chamber have been front and center on this. What have you guys been talking about? What are these exciting headlines we're reading about?
Well, it is exciting because it's exciting times, and not just exciting times in Salt Lake City, and not just because we have the International Olympic Committee here this week, but it's exciting all across the state because so many good things are happening across the state. As you both know well, because you are part of this, we have experienced in this state really an unprecedented era of economic prosperity. But at the same time, we recognize that we've got some local challenges associated with growth. We also have some national headwinds, the global headwinds associated with the national and international economy. And so the question that we have asked ourselves as a business community is, what can we do today to make sure that our era of prosperity continues far into the future? And that really is the premise behind Utah Rising.
Yeah, this vision, Utah Rising, a free enterprise vision for Utah's economy, it comes about 20 years after a similar effort focused on Salt Lake City's economic future. It expands the scope of the vision to businesses throughout the state. And I really appreciate that as part of this vision, Derek, you and other business leaders have clearly articulated some of the specific challenges facing our state: housing affordability, transportation, and growth. So with that, how does this vision specifically propose tackling those critical issues?
I think it's worth pointing out, when we talk about those challenges, that they're not just water cooler topics, right? They're not things that we just talk around the office. These are dinner table topics, meaning they are topics that everybody understands very well because they impact everybody. Transportation congestion, housing affordability, the risk to our quality of life. Ask any business today, what's your number one challenge? And they'll tell you finding enough employees, finding enough workforce. So you've asked the question, what is the goal for tackling them? Well, the first goal is to get organized. And that's exactly the phase that we're in right now. We're putting together an amazing steering committee made up of businesses and business leaders from all across the state. We also have a really robust technical committee that we've put together. We've met twice now. And these are all of the economic development organizations that have a specific role and responsibility, starting with the Governor's Office of Economic Opportunity. But there are many others: the World Trade Center Utah, Envision Utah, the Economic Development Corporation of Utah, Wasatch Front Regional Council. We also have local chambers of commerce across the entire state of Utah. Nobody knows their community like a local chamber of commerce knows it. So these are all people coming together around the table, and we have just started now to ask ourselves this question, what are we going to do about these challenges? And I also want to point out, it's not just about overcoming challenges, but we also have amazing opportunities. I mentioned the Olympics, Major League Baseball coming to Utah, National Hockey League coming to Utah, the University of Utah looking at building a downtown campus, looking at a campus joint with UVU at the point of the mountain. Amazing things with Inland Port happening around the state. So it's not just about problems to solve, it's about opportunities to capitalize on.
Yeah. Can I ask, Derek, I'm going to put you on the hot seat right now, and you don't have to answer if this is just speculation still, but we're getting an NHL team, right? This is happening next year, and is it going to be the Utah Yeti? Can we go with that yet, or are we still hoping?
Well, you've got my vote for the name. I love it. I hadn't heard that one before, but count me in on it. You know, when you talk to Ryan Smith, when you listen to him, and we actually had him come speak to our chamber board just a couple of weeks ago, and he talks about it in terms of it's a matter of when, it's not a matter of if. But what I love about the idea of the NHL, and the same is true of the MLB at the Power District on the west side of Salt Lake City, is these are projects that far exceed just a new sports franchise. They are a catalyst for driving economic development, whether that's on the west side in the Power District or whether that's downtown with a new sports, arts, and entertainment complex. I mean, these are generational projects. The Chamber was involved in 1979 when we originally brought the Jazz from New Orleans to Utah. So we've got a history of being involved in these kinds of things. We'll continue to be involved in these kinds of things because the business community has a responsibility. We have a role. We can't just say, hey, here's a problem. You, government, go solve this. That's not the Utah way. So much of what's been done in Utah since the days of 47 were about people coming together and addressing their own challenges and not expecting someone else to solve it for them.
Well, Derek, we saw so many people come together the last time we had the Olympics. In fact, I was a volunteer myself on the men's downhill. It was one of the funnest things I did. And I get chills thinking about the Olympics coming again.
You don't still ski in that jacket, do you, Rusty?
No, I sold it on eBay 2 weeks after the Olympics because it was worth a lot of money. Yeah. But I still see people up there wearing the same jacket 20 years later. It's fascinating. But Derek, how's that looking? I mean, it was such a magical time for Salt Lake. And everybody's hoping, obviously, 2034 is a year for it. What's the latest on that? You say the committee's here this week?
Yeah, the International Olympic Committee is here this week. And specifically what they're doing is looking at the venues to make sure that they have been kept up to date, which, of course, we know they have. They're making sure that everything that's been promised by the bid committee, which I'm honored to be a part of, that it's not just on paper promises, but actually coming and seeing for themselves that we can deliver exactly what we've said we can deliver. And the process this time is a little bit different than it was in 2002. In 2002, you're bidding with a bunch of other cities, and then they had this big announcement, of which, of course, we all remember. Now it's a little bit more process-oriented, where they select a community, which they have done with Salt Lake City, and then they go out and do their due diligence, which is what they're doing right now.
Yeah. Derek, we don't have a ton of time. We only have about a minute or so left, and I apologize. I have to ask a very difficult question and give you limited time to respond, but there is so much great news right now in Utah about our economic growth. The Wall Street Journal headlines about Utah having America's hottest job market, getting an MLB team, a National Hockey League team, all of these very positive, exciting things happening. But I guess my concern and my question is, the thing that really sticks in my mind is, how do we not grow so much and so fast that we lose our quality of life that makes Utah so special?
This is at the heart of what Utah Rising is all about, because we do not want to outgrow or outpace ourselves in a way that we lose the very thing that makes us special. And it's not just you and I that are concerned about this. I think most, if not all, of Utahns are concerned about this. But the fact of the matter is this: the challenges that we have are all associated with growth. They are real challenges. But we always have to remind ourselves We would never trade our challenges that for challenges that are associated with decline. Think about some of the parts of our country that are dealing with challenges, the doom loop. In addition to the Wall Street Journal headline that you cited about Salt Lake City having the hottest job market in the country, there was also a community that they highlighted in another article that, and I won't say it, but you can go and look it up. And it talked about this community and how it is in a doom loop and a death spiral because of challenges associated with decline. We have to remember the economy is like a shark. It either keeps swimming or it dies. And we need to make sure we keep swimming.
Well said.
Yeah, that's great. Derek, thank you so much for joining us. A very exciting topic. We appreciate your leadership and all that the Salt Lake Chamber does. Thank you for being with us tonight. Folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back with KSL at Night.
I'm Jeff Kaplan from KSL News Radio. Do you want to receive the latest news, traffic, and weather all in one place? All you have to do is subscribe to the KSL text line. Text the word NEWS to 57500 and you'll get the latest news, traffic, and weather updates. Sometimes before we get them on the air. I'll catch you on the radio weekday afternoons on KSL News Radio.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. This is Taylor Morgan alongside Rusty Cannon. Rusty, you and I have been talking a little bit off air about some of the challenges facing Utah, facing Salt Lake City and our communities. And homelessness, right, is immediately top of mind.
Top of the list.
And it's all too easy to perhaps just paint homeless Utahns with a very broad brush and make some easy assumptions about their choices and their circumstances. And I'm guilty. I'll be vulnerable and acknowledge that I have been very guilty of maybe jumping to many conclusions about many folks here in our community that are homeless. I am really excited about a new campaign that has recently launched here in Utah to help us really rethink how we see homelessness and those who are experiencing homelessness. I was watching some of the conference sessions over the weekend. I wasn't really doing a good job of watching, Rusty, I have to admit. But during some of the breaks between the sessions, I saw these new commercials, at least new to me, for what is called Project Human Dignity.
Yeah,
that was making some very compelling, heartfelt arguments about those who are going through a period of homelessness. And I have to say it caught my attention. It made me pause and it made me kind of reflect and perhaps even rethink this issue and how I see those that are struggling with this issue. Well, we are so fortunate to have joining us here on KSL at Night the executive director for the Miller Family Office, also involved very directly with what is called the Human or Project Human Dignity. Dawn Sterling, welcome to KSL at Night. Can you tell us what is Project Human Dignity?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me. And we're glad that you were able to see some of those commercials and that it caused you to pause and think a little bit.
It really did, yeah.
Project Human Dignity was really the outgrowth of there's been a ton of work for a long, long time done by many people in our community to help those experiencing homelessness. It is a hard issue. The solves are not easily found. There's great work being done. But when you're working and trying to assist and interfacing with humans, we're all different. And we all have our own different paths. And we have the things that we all struggle with. And Project Human Dignity really came out of the efforts of an organization called the Utah Impact Partnership. Utah Impact Partnership is a group that came together a few years back, and it's made up of civic leaders, those in the homelessness space, and philanthropists, really to raise awareness on behalf of those experiencing homelessness and to generate and create some community involvement. And I'm like you. When I saw the spots, and I live downtown, I see things every day, and I know it's hard for all of us to see other humans who are suffering. At times we see things and we see people and we make snap judgments. And many times those judgments are not correct and they're far off of where they should be. And so this really is an effort to say, hey, we're mothers, we're fathers, we're kids, we're veterans, we're people who have succeeded but maybe are on having hard times right now. And it's just to create a better human connection between ourselves and those who may be in need and need some assistance.
Yeah, so much of the conversation, Don, is about the mechanics and about the policy details of how we address the homelessness crisis. And it is such a difficult, complex, tough problem to address that often lost in that conversation is really the people, right? That need help, the people that are experiencing homelessness. And I really appreciate how the Project Human Dignity outlines kind of these four pillars. I'm on your website, projecthumandignity.org. Listeners, I encourage you to go and check this out. But your group talks about challenging public perception, inspiring action, advocating for progress, and building a compassionate community. So with those kind of principles in mind, how does challenging public perception, in your opinion, translate to better policy outcomes?
There's a general concept in the effort to help others, which is called proximity. Oftentimes, we can sit in our homes and look and maybe drive by a situation or drive by a problem and then go home and think about it and say, oh, I have all the answers. I know what needs to be done. And really what you find, and I think this is true of those experiencing homelessness, that the more we are willing to be proximate, meaning are we willing to sit down and have a conversation with somebody that is experiencing homelessness or somebody that had experienced homelessness is in that and is now out? What made the difference? I've had some experiences in my life. My mother suffered from deep mental illness. She was bipolar OCD, a really tough thing to go through for her. And there were times, and I lived in another city from my mom, lived in big cities. We lived in New York, we lived in Boston, and fortunately my mother was housed, but I would see people on the street and say to myself, first of all, there's a person who I would imagine their mother or father is worried about them. There's a person who is probably sending up prayers that somebody that runs into this person will be kind and will be willing to help out and will be willing to assist. And in my prayers and in my thoughts, I would just hope there were people in my mom's circle that would take good care of her and wouldn't let her come to harm, even though she had these deep mental issues. Okay. So the thing about Project Human Dignity is hopefully it provides us and to see those faces. And I was moved. The Larry H. and Gail Miller Family Foundation was able to be supportive in a funding way. And Gail, there are a lot of people that are doing a lot of great work. One of those people is Gail Miller when it comes to trying to help those
definitely
experiencing homelessness. But when you begin to think, what can I do? Well, that's the first question that you begin to ask yourself. And if the spots and those commercials cause you and your family and your friends to stop and say, hey, what is it that I could do? Or, hey, should I feel differently about those that I'm seeing on the street or in a homeless resource center or that are having a challenging moment. First of all, if it moves us to more empathy, if it moves us to more thoughtfulness, hey, I may not be able to help this person, but I could maybe make a contribution to Utah Impact Partnership or to the Road Home,
yeah,
or to any number of service providers out there. It's not an issue or a situation that will ever totally leave us.
Yeah.
We know the,
no
ahead,
question.
Sorry.
No, Don, thank you so much. We can't thank you enough for joining us here on KSL at Night, for the amazing work that you are doing at Project Human Dignity. Listeners, we encourage you to visit the website projecthumandignity.org to learn more. Don, we will have you back very soon to talk more about this. Unfortunately, we're out of time tonight, but really,
no worries. Thank
you so much.
Me.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Rusty, what a great conversation.
It was awesome what they're doing.
They've already opened my heart and made me rethink. And listen, I'm just one person, and I'm very grateful for this effort. I do believe it will help. Coming up next, Rusty, the weather is beautiful outside. It is forecasted to be beautiful outside this weekend, which
it
means it is time to spend your Saturday inside a convention hall at a county convention.
It is.
We're going to talk all about it after this.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Rusty Cannon. I'm here with Taylor Morgan. And tonight we are going to talk a bit about this weekend coming up. A busy weekend on the political scene in Utah. Of
Rusty,
course, Taylor, you're familiar with this.
Rusty, why is it that whenever it is county convention or state convention, it just so happens to be perfect weather? What is up with that? The one Saturday in the spring when I am stuck inside a convention hall with a bunch of nutty people all day long, Rusty, why does it have to be 70 degrees and perfectly beautiful sunny outside?
That's just, this is the way it works. That's your punishment, right?
Just one rainy day on convention is all
right.
I ask.
It would be nice. It's supposed to be a great weekend. At least this Saturday, I believe there's at least three county conventions. I live in Davis County, so we have Davis County, I think Salt Lake County, and then one other north as well. I'm actually helping volunteer at the Davis County convention, and we got a busy schedule. Federal candidates in and out. I think they're jumping around with three conventions. And as you know, these county conventions, you have legislative races, county races, all kinds of things. If you're looking for intense political action, it is happening at these conventions, right?
And I mean, anyone is welcome.
Is welcome to go. It's, in fact, if you've never been, I would suggest you go. It is a fascinating process to watch. It can get quite exciting, and they're important, right? It's where the delegates have been selected, go out and sort of kick the tires of these candidates and vote at these conventions. And one way for them to get on the primary ballot is through this convention system. So,
yeah.
I know in Davis County, there's several legislative races that are going to be closely watched. Some have gathered signatures to get on the primary ballot. Some have not. Our county commission, I think we have one spot and there are nine candidates running for one spot. So that'll be an interesting a vote as well. See how everybody tries to help themselves stand out amongst nine other candidates. It's not an easy job.
It's going to be very, very exciting. There are so many open seats throughout Utah, and particularly in these counties, there are some very competitive, hotly contested races among convention candidates in Davis County, in Salt Lake County. I know that other counties have recently held conventions or will shortly. State conventions for both the Utah Republican Party and the Democratic Party, their state conventions will both be on Saturday, April 27th.
Yes.
And so we're just a few weeks away from that as well. The deadline for signature gathering candidates to submit signatures for state races is Monday, the 15th.
Yeah, that's right. That's
so,
coming up.
Yeah, we are in the thick of election season, of convention and primary season. And really, a lot of the big, big competitive races will, if not necessarily decided at mm-hmm. convention, I think we'll come away from convention with a lot of indications as to who is the most competitive, who has the best campaign apparatus, who has really dialed in their strategy. We'll have a really good look into that coming out of county conventions and state convention on the 27th.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you have the statewide races as well as local races, and you want to build momentum out of the convention. You know,
yeah.
if you want to be on the primary ballot, whether you're doing that through the signature route or through the convention, you want momentum coming out of it. And obviously that's what everybody's shooting for. You'll have some broken hearts and, people that, don't make the cut, and it's tough to watch. And we salute those that run because
Absolutely.
It's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to have your name not listed at the top can be pretty humbling.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, everybody involved is doing the best they can. So it'll be an exciting weekend, and absolutely you'll be missing a morning tea time with some really good weather. Absolutely.
Well, I'm hoping I'll make up for it with maybe some cookies or treats or swag at candidate
swag.
Booths.
Yeah,
on
no,
Saturday.
You can have all the swag you want. Yeah. T-shirts, buttons, bottled water, you name it. You just bring a bag.
Well, and if you can't, listeners, if you're not able to attend a county convention in person this Saturday, be sure to follow KSL online on Twitter. The full team here at KSL News Radio, as well as KSL TV, will be at county conventions, dare I say, live tweeting it, or at least some of the best moments. Rusty?
Yes.
You have an official role with the Davis County Republican Party. Tell our listeners about that. And then I have a few questions for you.
Yeah. So the elections chair, I agreed to help with that. So our job as the elections team is to have the ballots ready to go and have the process run smoothly. Everybody wants a secure, good election.
Yeah.
They don't want to wait in a long line. They want to know the results as quick as possible, which is generally, easy to do. A lot of the races have two folks. There's the one race we mentioned that have nine. Well, they use instant runoff voting. So you rank your candidates one through nine.
Okay.
And there's a process that everybody is familiar with to go through and narrow that down. It's a great process to watch. But yeah, that's our hope, is for a very smooth Saturday.
Now, following up on the March 5th Republican caucus night, mm-hmm. obviously there were some issues there.
Yeah.
The state Republican Party and many of the county parties have faced pretty intense criticism from Republican voters who were very frustrated with how caucus night went, with how the presidential preference vote played out.
Yeah.
What, at least with Davis County, speaking mm-hmm. to your role and what you have seen so far in Davis County, what kind of steps or measures is the county party taking there in Davis to provide a better, more secure or more transparent process for Saturday?
Yeah, the Davis County Chair, Yemi, he's great. He's got it all buttoned up and ready to go. I think with the statewide, it was such a massive turnout and such a volunteer-driven effort, it was a little tough. And it was, the presidential preference poll, it was a little anticlimactic at that point just because everybody had dropped out and you essentially had two names plus one other name on there that it just wasn't quite as exciting. But the important thing is it is volunteer driven, right? And everybody does the best job they can.
Yeah.
And everybody's comfortable with it. This Saturday, I think the same with Davis, Salt Lake, and I can't remember who the other county is this Saturday. They'll all be going smoothly. Everybody's learned lessons. It's paper balloting. So they're, at least in our case in Davis County, so it's pretty hard to mess up paper balloting.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. On a personal level, mm-hmm. you have to be honest. What is your favorite thing about convention, and what is your least favorite element? It can be anything. Mm-hmm. Just be honest.
Well, I think everybody would say this. The length of it is sometimes a problem, right? You know, after 4 or 5 hours, you're like, okay, I have been here. I have done my part.
That's the worst. The worst is when the call to order the convention starts at 9 a.m. and there's a long line of folks trying to do like irrelevant bylaw changes or just fight about nothing, minutia, and you don't get around to voting on candidates or hearing candidate speeches until 5 or 6 p.m.
Yeah.
That drives me bonkers.
I agree. But you know what I love? The beauty about the caucus system, and I know everybody's got their opinion on it, is it allows anybody to run. Yeah. So you see people like, you know, the youngest legislator I believe ever elected was this past cycle, a police officer down in Provo, right?
Yeah.
You know, just you can go and run. You don't have to have those resources. There are issues, you know, with the caucus system. Yeah. We can talk a long time about that, which we're all familiar with. But that's the beauty of it. And eventually, I think if this changes, you'll see Utah change. But that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah.
But I think this Saturday, it's just an exciting thing. That's the thing that I really love to see is you see new people come about that are, you know, they don't have to be from great circumstances. Anybody can run and take a shot at it. Those races are won at kitchen tables, knocking on doors, because it's a smaller number of delegates you're dealing with. And so it's a crucible.
Yeah.
And so people go through that process and that's what's the beauty about it. But yeah, it sometimes takes a long time, especially if they're debating bylaws or things like that. It can be a bit of a slog.
Yeah. Well, and you know, as we continue hosting this show, you know, to be transparent by way of background, I'm kind of known as the Count My Vote guy. You know, that's my role. I'm the executive director of the organization that added this signature path to the ballot, essentially as another path outside of just caucus convention. Mm-hmm. So I still participate in caucus convention. I see a ton of value there. Mm-hmm. I think it's wonderful in theory, and sometimes in practice, the wheels fall off a little bit. But that doesn't mean I don't see that it has all those attributes that you mentioned. So we'll get into it. We're going to maybe have some great debates in the future about the process, and I really look forward to that. So,
thank you for listening to KSL Night. We will be back shortly with Congressman Blake Moore. You're going to want to stay tuned.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. This is Taylor Morgan here with Rusty Cannon. Rusty, we have had a great show so far.
Yes.
Love having you here, co-piloting your first KSL at Night show. Looking forward to many, many more to come.
Thank you.
Before we started recording, Rusty, we were talking about Speaker Mike Johnson.
Yeah.
Speaker Johnson did an incredible interview with Boyd Matheson here on KSL News Radio yesterday. Listeners, you can go back, you can listen to that full interview, and you can find any prior recorded shows or segments of shows at kslpodcast.com. So I want to make sure listeners know how to go and listen to Boyd's interview with Speaker Johnson. Congresswoman Celeste Malloy was also part of that conversation. But Rusty, you and I were discussing how this guy, this Mike Johnson, who, look, I'm not in D.C. right now. I'm not an expert on all things Congress right now, at least. I didn't know him very well. I knew the name, but he came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And turns out he is maybe doing a really, really good job, Rusty. The question I have is, what is the secret sauce that Mike Johnson has that is appearing to be very effective in what has been a very dysfunctional U.S. House of Representatives? So that is what is top of my mind, the thing that I keep thinking about. And I thought, who better to give us some insight into what is happening in the U.S. House of Representatives than Congressman Blake Moore, who is joining us now on KSL at Night. Congressman, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to join us. What is Mike Johnson? What is special?
Who better to talk about dysfunction than me? Yeah,
no, Congressman, that's not. It's quite the opposite, actually. You, in fact, are part of a leadership team in the Republican majority U.S. House that is actually being very effective.
Absolutely.
But in good ways, right? Yeah. Typically, I love a dysfunctional Congress because my rights and my tax dollars are maybe less threatened. But this U.S. House appears to be highly effective and even maybe bipartisan. I don't know. You can tell us about it, Congressman.
Yeah, I'm not gonna sugarcoat the fact that we've had a lot of internal fights within the House GOP, and it's been tough because not many people understand what like a procedural rule vote is.
but many, many votes have not been able to come to the floor because we have blocked that rule vote, which is such an uncommon thing, and it is a very frustrating part. But when you look at the big picture about getting stuff done, look, it was very important for Republicans to win back the House, because you had a President Biden who had a White House, House, and Senate all under one party control. And when you do that, you have the ability to pass some really, really large spendy legislation that led to a lot of inflation. And just by us being in the majority, we're able to block all of that, like completely zeroed that all out and giving no opportunity. And all we then need to make sure we do is some of the basics, which is what the appropriations process was. We found areas of cut, wasteful spending. We took advantage of that while supporting defense strongly. Like, it was ultimately a win, but there's always fights about it and all that. But, you know, Speaker Johnson has been able to navigate and get us through avoiding government shutdowns that were going to be for no reason, really. You know, there wasn't the leverage point that we needed to do, the stake in the ground we had to have for a shutdown of something we wanted to get done, because we already gave up that opportunity on the border. Most Republicans voted to do the border security bill, but 21 didn't last fall, and we gave up that leverage, right? So we can get into all that. Speaker Johnson is excellent job of navigating all of the difficult personalities and the individualism that's kind of rampant right now in the GOP, because this is a team sport in a lot of ways. And if you don't stick together, you don't have anywhere near as much influence. And that's what he's been really pushing for and striving for. So it hasn't been pretty, but we have been able to navigate and avoid the calamities that could otherwise happen.
You know, Congressman Moore, the question I had years ago, I had the opportunity to visit with Paul Ryan when he was speaker back then. I asked him a question. I'd have the same question now. How in the world do you navigate so many personalities and so many egos, frankly? But the question that we have right now is this motion to vacate. What is the status of that? It just seems like that's an issue that he is handling well at this point. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, so former Speaker Newt Gingrich, and I love being the first, you know, I love being a guest for Rusty's first show. That's awesome. So
yeah.
Great, Mr. Cannon.
Lucky you.
Former Speaker Gingrich called Speaker Johnson a few weeks ago and said, I couldn't have done what you're doing. I had a 19-seat majority or something like that with no social media. And Speaker Johnson's got the opposite. We have a one-vote majority right now with a rampant sort of incentive to make hay and oh, I'm fighting against leadership, and so I'm going to make a name for myself and all that. So yeah. I think with this case currently, how in the world are you going to vacate? So Marjorie Taylor Greene has decided she wanted to put this up, I believe largely for attention getting. Big shocker there. But she's trying to do it over this very same thing that she didn't vacate McCarthy for. So the double standard is rampant in these little efforts that go on. Because all Speaker Johnson has done is finish the process that Speaker McCarthy started on the appropriations process. And I can't drill this home enough. We are talking about less than one quarter of our entire budget about what people complain about, when the other side of the budget, the 75%, runs rampant. It grows at a wildly rapid rate, when the appropriations process is actually very well constrained with an enormous amount of oversight because we vote on it each year.
Yeah.
The other stuff gets enacted and you never touch it. You never even vote on it. My bill would change that, but like that's where the problem of our debt is driven from, is those mandatory direct spending items.
Yeah.
And so to go after McCarthy for finding a process that reduces spending in areas we don't care as much about as Republicans and support defense and veterans still, and then vacate him that, and then for Johnson to finalize the process as best as he possibly could with as much leverage as we gave him. We didn't give him as much leverage as we should have because we didn't stay united and give him 218 Republican votes. He got through that process as well as you could. So it's a very, very big double standard to, like, it's hypocritical to say, oh, I'm going to vacate you now. You didn't vacate McCarthy over the same exact thing a little while ago, but it's a fundamental miscue on actually dealing with our major debt drivers. But it's because it's the only thing we vote on spending that they want to, that this folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene want to use as a way to drum up all this rage, when it's not actually the problem of our debt.
So what happens, let's say, over the next week? I mean, this stuff seems to change by the hour. If you can't forecast, what does the next week look like?
So she put it out there knowing there was a 2-week break and, you know, it wasn't going to come up, or it was kind of like a, let's let that simmer out there and we can, over the next week. FISA is one of the most important things we'll deal with, and we're struggling to finalize that this week. I don't see movement there on the vacate. maybe something with Ukraine. She could try to do, but I think she's at a point where she's sort of backed herself into a corner right now. And like, if she doesn't go through with it, people will realize it was just always a pretend threat anyway. But if she does go through with it, I don't think there's really enough support. And really, Democrats are, if they're wise, they'd be like, well, we'll just leave the chamber and reduce the threshold, and you know, we're not gonna go through this whole like drama of trying to choose a new speaker for something that he's doing in a very reasonable, sound, thoughtful way.
Yeah, I have to say the way he has handled it so far really seems to have just diffused that situation. And again, I can't give him enough credit for at least my perspective that he is doing an incredible job in very difficult circumstances with a very tight majority. So appreciate that leadership. Appreciate your service there, and always grateful to have you join us here on KSL at Night, and grateful for the very direct and honest, frank way you are willing to talk about tough issues with the listeners. Really grateful for that, Congressman. Looking forward to have you back soon.
Thank you both.
Okay, thank you, Rusty. Great conversation.
That was awesome.
Congressman Utah's Blake lucky to Moore, have him. Friend of the show, representative, doing such a great job of keeping us informed about what's happening on the ground in the U.S. House of Representatives. Coming up next, we are going to stay with Congress and hit on some of the hottest issues right now that Speaker Mike Johnson, Congressman Blake Moore, and others will have to vote on in the coming weeks. Stay right here, listeners.
The murder of two men forces their families to wrestle with impossible questions. Who is forgiveness for? Does everyone deserve a second chance? Follow season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL Night. I am Rusty Cannon, and I'm here with Taylor Morgan. And now we're going to talk about an interesting subject that's come up in Washington, D.C. As we can see, Taylor, sometimes things get a little hot back there, and there's been an issue that has been quite hot today, actually. A bill having to deal with FISA. Surveillance, right? This is, I guess, an outgrowth of the last 20 years.
Anything in Congress is going to be an acronym.
That's right.
So walk us through what FISA stands for.
I believe it is federal. I should know.
Oh,
that.
No, I put you on the spot.
You put me
I'm
on
so
the
sorry.
Spot. I know the F is federal, right? That's as far as, but I believe the S and A is Surveillance Act. I just can't remember what the I is all of a sudden.
The thing is, I think it is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. But Rusty, yes. I didn't know that until I just looked it up here.
You're faster on Google than me. But this has caused some controversy as we're reading the headlines back in D.C., where a vote is coming up in the House, possibly, to reauthorize this. And it seems like this debate comes up over and over as it's reauthorized as to whether this is okay, because it's designed for foreign sources, right, from my understanding. And you would support our intelligence community on doing the surveillance that they need to do.
Yeah.
To keep us safe. But the question I think comes into play of, okay, when does it wrap in citizens? And I believe the debate today is about whether or not they're going to add a provision onto this bill to require a warrant for
okay.
a FISA.
Interesting.
And that's the big question.
And we saw that former President Donald Trump had urged before this vote, mm-hmm. Trump had urged House Republicans to reject.
Correct.
Reauthorization of the law. That obviously, it appears as if at least that had a significant impact on the vote outcome. Now, some are trying to spin this as a leadership crisis of Mike Johnson. I don't think it is that. I think that this has failed before in a Republican majority U.S. House of Representatives. I do believe that personally, my opinion is that there are some serious questions about FISA.
Yeah.
I am of the opinion that we may have gone too far with surveillance, and particularly surveillance of American citizens abroad.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, one of the key criticisms of FISA and one of the reasons it wasn't reauthorized.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the question becomes, when you're wrapping in citizens, do you need a warrant for such as this? And I know some of our elected officials have weighed in. I know Senator Lee is actively campaigning on getting a warrant provision put in, even though it's on the House side. He's been quite active on the Twitters, as I like to still call it.
Sure.
Talking about this. And this is an issue that is going to come up time and time again. And the question is, what happens next in the House? Is this reauthorization going to happen? There's been some argument that, you know, somehow this is Speaker Johnson's doing and what have you is the control that he has with the floor. But it's an interesting battle that, in addition to the surveillance aspect, gets into how the sausage is made in Washington, D.C., right?
Speaking of that, I think it's interesting that House Democrats, every Democrat in the U.S. House voted against. They voted with Donald Trump, if you will.
Can you believe it?
They voted against reauthorization. Only 19 Republicans voted against renewing FISA. So I don't think it's fair to say this is a crisis within the Republican majority. I do believe that there are Republicans that have significant concerns.
Yeah.
It does appear to be a partisan vote for Democrats. So really, when Speaker Mike Johnson says he thinks he can get this done, he thinks he can cross the finish line, he thinks we can get the FISA renewal done, but he acknowledges that there are some issues with it, that he needs to work with these Republicans to address their concerns, but he still believes there's enough time this week to get it renewed. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's realistic?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, we've seen them pull things across the finish line at the last minute all the time. And, you know, they're all back there at least another 24 hours before they all fly home, but for the week. But I think it's also an interesting take on the current dynamic with the, you know, the presidential race and all of that. President Trump weighing in on saying, I think he effectively put out on his social media channel to kill this because of, you know, the Warren issue. And
he literally wrote all caps. So he was yelling, quote, kill FISA.
That's right. He loves the caps lock.
Oh,
right?
Boy.
And so it was definitely with the caps lock on.
So does my dad, but I don't think he means to.
That's right. And so, you know, but for those involved in the political process, like we often are, it's interesting to just look at, you know, how all this works, whether it's a rules fight or whether it's an amendment fight or whether, you know, there are so many different ways to steer legislation back there to move it forward or to kill it. I think it's often somewhat confusing for folks, but I think that the battle lines are pretty clear on this issue as of today, where there are those that want to add the provision to say, okay, you need a warrant in these cases, or you can't do it. And then there's others that think, okay, hold on, we're putting essentially our national security at risk here and not reauthorizing this as soon as we need to be reauthorized when, you know, you just don't want to trip this up. And so I think it gets to a broader question too of what it's like to run the House. I don't, you know,
absolutely.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we know that this would be a five year renewal. Mm-hmm. The package as it stands now does include some important reforms. And so perhaps some of those reforms don't go far enough, or there are some missing pieces that Speaker Mike Johnson and leadership there in the House can negotiate to get this over the finish line by the end of the week. But to pivot from the FISA conversation in the U.S. House, Rusty, I want to tie this in to your work on Utah's Capitol Hill.
Sure.
You and I both... I don't like to use the dirty L word, but we're both lobbyists. We're registered lobbyists in Utah.
You have to be up there.
That is part of the deal to follow the law. We're registered, we're licensed, we're members of the Capitol Hill Association. So we often see one another up there at the Capitol. And I think you are often a lot busier tied in the deep, deep, deep weeds of tax legislation. Mm-hmm. There is perhaps, I don't know, very few issues or more difficult with details and policy and weeds and consequences, unintended, intended, than tax policy. Mm-hmm. And of course, the budget in general is all about tax policy.
Yeah.
As a representative, you're the president of the Utah Taxpayers Association, and you lobby on behalf of taxpayers in Utah, right?
Correct.
You're representing Utah voters there.
Taxpayers.
In your work on the Hill. What are some of the experiences you have had to negotiate these kinds of very weedy policy details? You know, you don't have a key senator on board does that mean there's a crisis of support for your issue, or mm-hmm. is it a matter of working out the details? What is that like?
You know, it's interesting. You accumulate war stories over the years, and I haven't had as many years as many, but some that can be shared on air and some that can't, right?
Of course.
You know, yeah. as far as experiences, but
who is your least favorite Utah senator, right?
Not saying a
just
word.
Kidding.
But you see what's effective and what's not. And, you know, a lot of the work is done behind the scenes, and that doesn't mean in secret. It just means that the hard work is done, you know, before a hearing, before a committee, you know, in the interim now, like we just finished the session. We started the day after the session, literally talking about the issues for next session with legislators. It happens that fast and ticked off conversations that will now happen over the summer and the fall. And this is all aside from their elections. And so you have to do your homework. And so it's fascinating to be part of it. That's really the enjoyable part of our job. That's the fun part. You know, the not so fun parts are going to city council meetings and getting yelled at and those kinds of things. But up on the Hill, it's a good group of people. You just have to do your homework and manage the process. That's what's happening in DC. And just like you tied these two issues on Utah's Capitol Hill, you do the same thing. You work with the process. You give people good data, and, you know, you let them know both sides of the issue. And they respect that. And then that makes you effective. And that's what we hope.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you. I have a lot more deeply awkward personal questions, Rusty, that I'll ask you in future segments. But we are out of time. Great conversation about FISA, about negotiating with lawmakers, whether it's here in Utah or back in D.C. I'm really excited to have your wealth of expertise on the show.
Well, that's kind of you. And speaking of awkward, our next subject when we come back will be on religion and politics and tying the two. So we're making it even more intense. So stay with us. KSL at Night. We'll be right back.
The murder of two men forces their families to wrestle with impossible questions. Who is forgiveness for? Does everyone deserve a second chance? Follow season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. This is Taylor Morgan alongside Rusty Cannon. Brand new host here at KSL at Night. We are breaking you in, Rusty. Listeners, speaking of breaking, you can always get breaking news directly to your phone with updates from KSL News Radio. You can sign up for those updates just by texting the word breaking to 57500. That's breaking to 57500. You'll get those breaking news updates directly to your device. So Rusty, moving on from that, I want to have a conversation about the intersection of religion and politics here in Utah. It's something that is often the elephant in the room.
It is.
And not the Republican elephant, so to speak.
Correct.
No pun intended. However, I think it is fair to say that there has historically been, and when I say historically, I'm talking probably the last 50 years or so, there has historically been a very close tie or connection to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its members and support of Republican candidates, the Republican Party platform, at least here in Utah.
Yeah.
Now, some of that could be shifting, right? There are some arguments out there. I may not agree with them, but there are those who are claiming that the National Republican Party and former President Donald Trump have pushed some Utah Republicans to maybe consider voting for different candidates or maybe affiliating with a different party. I think that has happened to a very small degree, potentially. I don't think it's anything significant or any wave. I don't think that, as some would claim, Utah is turning blue. I don't think that's happening at all. I think Utah is more red today than it ever has been,
frankly.
But when we talk about religion and politics, candidates in Utah have often done a very delicate, sensitive dance. And I've been a part of this in terms of messaging, testing the messaging with quantitative research, with qualitative focus groups, researching how candidates can tell voters, how can candidates communicate to voters that they share their values without stepping too far into the realm of exploiting one's faith or shared faith as a means to getting votes.
Yeah, it's a very gray area that's tough to navigate. And it's one of those things like you kind of recognize it when you see it or feel it, where it's, oh, okay, they're pushing this a little too far. It's awkward. It's like three things you don't bring up, right? Religion and politics, and then maybe selling life insurance or something like that. You don't talk about in mixed company, and it just makes everybody uncomfortable. So we're talking about mixing two of those, right? And it's tough because people a lot of times use it as a gauge or as an indicator of you know, whatever they're looking for. And so candidates have to navigate what they feel comfortable and then also navigate what delegates or voters feel comfortable with. And it's sometimes tough. And as we've seen, there's some that push it too far. Absolutely.
No doubt. I think that, you know, there are some terminology. There are some things that candidates say that are clues, right? That are instructive. Things like fifth generation Utah or, you know, proud to have pioneer ancestry or talk about pioneering spirit or pioneering values. You know, these are kind of maybe the safe implied expressions.
Yeah.
Do you think it's fair to say, and again, I'm just talking about this historical perception, and perception can be reality in politics, but there is a perception among voters that if you have an R next to your name, then you are probably more likely to be a member of the predominant faith and thereby are more likely to share some important values or principles that voters who are members of the predominant faith here in Utah would have. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair. And obviously everyone wants to talk about the changing of the state, right? Which is fair. And obviously everybody, you know, wants to be able to take part in, you know, either party or any ideology that they want. It's just, it's a tough issue to navigate because of, you know, the background of Utah.
Yeah.
But we, you know, you've been involved in this type of stuff for a long time as well as myself. You've seen people that push it too far.
Yeah.
And we've also seen people that navigate it just about right. I mean, you don't have to wear it on your sleeve. I think there's ways to do the messaging that you feel comfortable with without making everyone else feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And there are some candidates that have certainly made people feel uncomfortable.
Yes. Well, and we're going to get to that because I have a very specific example that I want to cite as I think a candidate who is maybe taking it way too far. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, to me, it's offensive.
Yeah.
I do want to give Democrats in Utah, I want to be fair and represent them accurately, that it is not true to say that Democratic legislators or Democratic candidates are not necessarily also members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm not saying that's a litmus test for being a good public official or not, of course.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about the perception among voters who are members of that faith and how they see Democrats in Utah. There's this perception, perhaps among many Republican voters, that Democrats in Utah are only Democrats because they are not members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. That's simply not true. That's not accurate. Many of our Democratic legislators are indeed also share that predominant faith. There's a diversity of faith perhaps that is more pronounced among some Democrats in Utah, but it's not cut or dry, right? It's not religious affiliation is not at all tied to party affiliation necessarily among candidates. However, Democratic candidates often feel the need to overcorrect and communicate to voters that it's safe to vote for them because they're also a member of that predominant faith.
It happens.
Okay. Here's the example I want to talk about. Democratic candidate for Utah Governor Brian King.
Yeah.
Rusty has sent out fundraising letters, and I know because I've received one. He has posted on social media very overt statements about his faith. In a fundraising letter that I received, he referred to his service as an LDS bishop, quoting his letter, LDS bishop.
Really?
He also made many other direct references to his membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as a direct call for members of that faith to vote for him because of his shared faith. He's referred in social media posts to being a great, great, great grandson of Hiram Smith, brother of founder and prophet Joseph Smith, founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Very overt posts were shared on his social media from the conference center during conference center this last weekend, talking about his faith and directly appealing to voters to support him because of that faith. Mm. And I, like, I want you to push back on me if I'm overreacting,
no,
Rusty,
you're not.
I was offended by that.
Yeah.
Because I know Brian King and I share that faith,
mm-hmm.
but when he starts to use that shared faith to persuade voters to vote for him because of that shared faith,
mm-hmm.
I think that's crossing the line.
I would agree. I'm surprised a fundraising letter is quite surprising where you'd mention things like that. If you have to remind people of certain things like that, then I think, you know, one would be doing it wrong.
Yeah.
The right way to do it is that everybody can find out in their own way. It doesn't have to be you that reminds them.
Yeah.
Right. And it just makes everybody uncomfortable, especially when it comes to a fundraising letter. That's a step too far.
And I really like Brian King. I think he's been an effective Democratic legislator. He's been minority leader.
Mm-hmm.
We've had him on the program several times. You know, Brian King is a very nice person. And I think that's why I was shocked and very disappointed by his messaging around his faith. I would, you know, make an open invitation to Brian King to have him on the program, have him on
Absolutely.
This show
yeah.
to talk about this messaging, to talk about using his role as a bishop in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as a means to raise money from voters. I'd like him to talk about that and explain his reasoning. And you know what? Hey, maybe I could be wrong. And I would welcome that conversation.
Yeah, welcome the conversation.
But as of right now, I think he's taking it too far.
So. Agreed.
Well, great conversation, Rusty. Certainly more to come down the road on that topic. Coming up next, we're going to wrap up the show tonight here on KSL at Night by asking the question, are Americans getting lazier, Rusty, or perhaps smarter?
That is
right?
a good question.
Are we working harder or just trying to avoid working altogether? You know, are we working smarter or not working is the question. We will answer it, or try to at least.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
After the break. Stay right here.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Rusty Cannon here with Taylor Morgan. And we are talking tonight about an interesting question, Taylor. Are Americans getting lazier or smarter?
Yeah.
Now, this is gonna go across generations here. Now, I'm getting older.
Okay.
And so I'm crossing that mark.
How old are you?
I'm 51. Right. So I can be officially an old man.
You seem a lot younger. I would peg you mid to late 40s at the oldest.
Well, that's kind of you. But no, 51, and you know, maybe in that older generation now. It's interesting when you know you look at this question, getting lazier or smarter. I thought of one of my kids. We were talking one time about learning things, and I think it was on car repairs, and he reminded me, you know, Dad, I can get on YouTube and figure out some of this stuff in 15 minutes on how to do it, versus myself maybe go to the library, you know, or
check out a book
you know, with the Dewey Decimal System or whatever the case may be, and find out in how to do something or what have you. And it gets to the question, you know, it would that make someone lazier or smarter? And you know, it makes them smarter, not lazier. They get things done, but it opens up a different conversation, you know, about the work week and other things. So we've seen some legislation or some ideas on legislation that, you know, let's maybe go to a 4-day week work week or something like that. What do you think of this movement?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. We did a segment here on KSL at Night just a couple weeks ago. And as I say that, I should remind listeners that you can go and find any prior recorded show here on KSL at Night, any full show or any segment of a show. You can find all of that at kslnewsradio.com. You can search for KSL at Night. You can find all of our shows and segments in podcast format. So plenty of great content there. So when we refer to past segments, listeners, it's easy to find. You can get it there online on our website. But we did this segment, Rusty, a couple weeks ago, and we talked about a new study asking Americans throughout the country of all ages, what was the most important thing that they would want to be known for after they passed? What is the one attribute? If you could choose any descriptor or attribute that people said about Rusty Cannon after you'd moved on, what would you want that to be? Well, for Americans 60 and older, the boomers.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not a boomer, so you're not even close to being a boomer. So you know.
I think officially I'm a Gen Xer.
Nice. Yes. Okay. So boomers and older, they wanted to be known as hard workers. It was all about the work ethic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, for younger Americans, they wanted to be remembered for creativity. And I think this really does tie into this conversation about working harder, working smarter, because Americans have always worked hard. We have had that work ethic. And I don't know about your childhood, but my parents are very much boomers, early 70s. Mm-hmm. Work ethic was the most important thing. That was instilled in me. I worked so many manual jobs growing up. The most important thing to my parents is if I had a job.
Yeah.
Nothing else mattered, right? How's life going? How's school going? You dating anybody, this or that? The most important thing growing up to my parents was if I had a job and how hard I was working at that job, right? That is what really drove them. I think that's wonderful. I think that's valuable. But I grew up with a desire with a work ethic. I like to think I have a work ethic, but my desire growing up was to actually work smarter and have more free time for creative outlets, maybe for playing outside, doing the activities I love. And as a father of two boys right now, I cherish the time I have away from work to spend with my family, to spend with them. That means I am trying to work fewer hours, work smarter so that I have more free time to pursue those kinds of things. So I don't know. Does that mean I'm lazy?
No, it doesn't mean you're lazy at all. In fact, I was thinking about an audiobook I listened to recently. Arnold Schwarzenegger, he wrote a book recently.
That has to be good.
Yeah, it was great. And he read it, it's great to hear his voice.
That's because wonderful. Of
his accent. But his father, I remember him relating, his father would always say to him, Arnold, whatever you do, be useful. Right. And that was his father was a bit of a tyrant. He talks about it and fairly hard on him, but he instilled that work ethic. But I think that can translate into both of these camps where are you being useful? Are you being effective? Right. And if a 32-hour work week instead of a 40-hour work week or you can do things more efficiently, you know, maybe that's not the sign of laziness. That's the sign of, you know, being smarter, I think. And you can do that. Are you useful? Are you effective? I think is what everybody should be shooting for.
Yeah. Yeah. Is this a generational thing is the question. I mean, I know that among younger Americans, we talk about maybe creativity. Well, let's talk about, the boogeyman here when it comes to working. And that's, of course, I like to tease the millennials for still living in their parents' basement and still trying to create an app and not being actually willing to pay their dues and work hard to build a career. So I like to tease millennials about that, even though I know that's a caricature and it's not always true. However, according to new polling, and we have a great story by Jennifer Graham in the Deseret News about the right to disconnect laws and shorter work weeks, asking this question. Listeners, you can find that at DeseretNews.com. But ultimately, as she reports, younger Americans, 30 and younger, are not all in on the relentless pursuit of economic growth, as they refer to it. They're wanting to work less, and they are more likely, by a large margin, to support political efforts like Bernie Sanders' bill to limit the work week to 32 hours.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders making sure everybody does their fair share, as he says, right?
You don't have to pay your student loans. No, you don't have to work 40 hours. I mean, yeah.
Well, yeah, and I think that's the question is just when do you cross the line where it becomes, you know, seen as laziness or is laziness, right? I mean, I think this was part of the, you know, the COVID time that we lived through where all of a sudden everybody was working at home and, you wonder how much is getting done and are people being more effective or less effective? That's a huge debate.
Yeah.
Right? But, I think many organizations now, like that changed the way that we work, right? As an association where more of our work, we could drive to work and sit in traffic and then sit in front of our computer at the office.
Right.
Or we can avoid that and just stay at home and do the same thing. And you're just as effective.
But in the post-pandemic world, right? Businesses of all kinds, shapes and sizes really rethought the need to be on site in person.
Correct.
Right?
I mean, there's times where you need some collaboration and what have you. And I think people, clearly can abuse this, but cause you're at home, we all know the same thing. Oh, I got to take the garbage out, or hey, how about I mow the lawn real quick or what have you, those kinds of things, maybe would give an employer a little bit of consternation, but I think it is definitely a generational thing. I can think of a lot of, older folks that we know that would be, hey, you putting in your 60 hours?
Yeah.
You know, if not, that's a problem.
Absolutely.
You know, and others, they'll say 60 hours. What are you talking about?
Okay. So we don't have a ton of time. We have a couple minutes left, Rusty, but I know you have an older son who is currently working full time in Congress as a staffer for a senator.
Correct.
That is a demanding job. I spent a little time in Congress. I have a sense of what that's like. I want you to say if you think these descriptions would apply to your son.
Mm-hmm.
Younger Americans, again, as reported by Jennifer Graham in the Deseret News, younger Americans want a, quote, gentler workplace with more time off, pet insurance, and they want the right to disconnect, right? Meaning if their boss texts them in the evening when they're trying to settle in and watch Netflix or something using, you know, their parents' password, let's be honest. Okay.
Yeah.
That is what they want in a workplace. Do you think your son sees it that way?
I don't. Maybe some do, but I think he, along with others that have certain jobs like this, know that you are on demand whenever you need to be.
Yeah.
You can't go crawl in a hole and say, no, time out for me. You got to be on call, and that's part of the job.
Yeah.
Everybody understands that.
Well, certainly it's an interesting conversation. We will keep that discussion going. There's probably some other sides to this that, you know, we need to take, you know, and consider. And, you know, hey, younger Americans are the future. So
we
need them to be motivated in the workforce.
Yeah, that's right. Whether you're young or older, we want to encourage everybody to continue to tune in to KSL at Night. We'll have another great show tomorrow night. It has been a blast being part of this. And thanks again, Taylor. And we will see you all tomorrow night.
Thanks for listening.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.